This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Surviving spikes in drug prices. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Kashenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The cost of insulin has nearly doubled over the past few years, leading some families to try extreme measures to make it last.
Do you tend to use sites like Airbnb or Uber? We'll have warnings about the darker side of the sharing economy.
A teacher has given students a detailed homework assignment for the Christmas break that's gone viral. Hear why parents are applauding it.
And why Mrs. Claus isn't drawing the same attention or wages this time of year as Santa.
So there's not a lot of call for a Mrs. Claus to appear with Santa, and then nobody wants Mrs. Claus on her own.
Wall Street Journal columnist Ann Cadet on the struggles to do appearances as Mrs. Claus this time of year. Mindy Patterson's family pays nearly $1,000 each month for insulin. Her husband and two teenage sons all have type 1 diabetes and need insulin to survive. But the medicine they so desperately depend on comes at a hefty price. The family pays between $300 and $400 per person in out-of-pocket costs on insulin each month. In people with type 1 diabetes, the pancreas can't make insulin. Those with the condition require several doses of insulin a day. And by one measure, the cost is up nearly 100% over the past 7 years. Costs continue to rise, so much so that almost half of people with diabetes have temporarily skipped taking their insulin. It's a story by Megan Henry, healthcare reporter at the Columbus Dispatch in Ohio. Megan, take us through this.
Yeah, so diabetes affects millions of people in the U.S., and people with type 1 diabetes spent $5,705 per person on insulin in 2016, according to the nonprofit Healthcare Cost Institute. And insulin is vital for people with diabetes, especially people with type 1 diabetes, since their pancreas doesn't make insulin, which we need. And that price, almost $6,000, that's 99% increase since 2012. So that doubles, putting a tremendous strain on people with diabetes who require this insulin. I talked to a family from Dayton, Ohio, and their family pays nearly $1,000 for insulin each month, since three people in their household need insulin. They're all type 1 diabetics, and so without this, they would not survive. And so they spend upwards of, you know, $12,000 a year on insulin.
Why is it that prices have spiked so much the last few years?
That's a good question. It's hard to point exactly one finger at this issue, but it seems to be just a mix of the three drug makers who make the insulin, Sanofi, Novo Nordisk, or Eli Lilly, as well as the pharmaceutical benefit managers and the health insurance companies, and also just increasing out-of-pocket prices just seem to be all kind of mixing into this pot of raising insulin prices.
And there's one theme that seems to come up with a lot of these stories, as you know, more than most, the idea of a lack of transparency. Like, nobody can really figure out what's going on, right? Nobody necessarily pays with the retail price, but once the pharmacy benefit managers get involved with the drug companies and the health insurance companies, the consumer is just kind of left to shrug shoulders and empty a wallet.
Right, exactly.
All right, so where does this go from here? I mean, is there any relief in sight for some of these people who have to pay this much out of pocket?
Hopefully there's some relief coming down the pike in Ohio. State Representative Dr. Beth Litson, a Democrat, introduced a package of bills about a month ago focused on insulin pricing. One of those bills would cap the price of insulin provided by health care plans at $100 for a 30-day supply here in Ohio. That bill was recently introduced, so there hasn't been much movement on it, so it takes some time to see that come to fruition. But if that bill would pass, that would help out families like the Pattersons in the story. And there also is a House bill that she also introduced that required the Attorney General here in Ohio to give recommendations about insulin pricing in the state and just investigate why is this so expensive for families. So hopefully there's some relief in sight. It's kind of hard to say, though.
Yeah. We'll speak with Megan Henry, healthcare reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, part of the USA Today network. She's written a fascinating piece entitled Insulin Prices Double, Causing Many People with Diabetes to Turn to Extremes. So you point out, too, there's another family who they feel one of their lost loved ones was actually rationing the insulin to try to, you know, afford it and pay the bills.
Yes, yes. So Patterson, her sister-in-law, Megan Carter, whose brother actually has insulin, is a diabetic as well. She was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 2000. She had some brushes with diabetic ketoacidosis, a condition in which blood sugars get too high and the body's blood sugar becomes acidic a couple times. And then at that point, she started rationing on and off just to prolong her supply of insulin. Unfortunately, then she lost her job as a nurse in June of last year and her health insurance along with it. So she was paying nearly $1,000 for 3 little vials of insulin to last her like a month. And so on Christmas Eve about a year ago, she started throwing up and showing symptoms of diabetic ketoacidosis and then ended up basically dying from complications related to diabetes because she was just rationing her insulin as a way to try to prolong her supply. So this family in Dayton is really gung-ho about lowering the prices so it doesn't happen again.
Thanks, Megan. Megan Henry, healthcare reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, part of the USA Today network. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. The holiday season is upon us, and between the rituals of hanging up lights and shopping for gifts, there's another event to remember, the Office Holiday Party. Do's and Don'ts from Jonathan Bell, employment attorney and founder of the Bell Law Firm in New York. Jonathan, what should we know?
2 major factors that people have to know. Okay, number one, the sexual harassment aspect. Right? Someone has a crush on somebody else. They're always fearful to say something. All of a sudden, they figure they'll do it at the holiday party when everybody's drinking. Guards are down. However, the person that's being flirted with doesn't appreciate it and makes a complaint, could be subjecting the company to exposure. So a company should basically write an email before a holiday party explaining that this is still a working event. Everybody has to dress professionally, act appropriately, and not, if there is alcohol being served, don't drink excessively.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's point number one. Point number two, and this is also very important, a lot of states, including New York, has something called the Dram Shop Law. Okay? So what happens with the Dram Shop Law, it says that if somebody is visibly intoxicated and has a drink of alcohol and then goes out and kills somebody or permanently disfigures somebody, the person or the company or the organization that served them the drink could be responsible.
Mm.
So this could literally put a company out of business because, you know, maybe an insurance policy is a limited amount and someone's really seriously injured. They see a company behind an event, a deep pocket, and now you could really be on the hook for millions of dollars. So those are really the 2 aspects of it. Employees need to know that this is a business outing. Just because you're not actually in your office, you could still be subjected to discipline, including termination, depending how you act. So just act appropriately and act like it's a business event. For companies that are huge companies and can't keep their eye on everybody, my recommendation would be either no alcohol at all or give out drink tickets, maybe 1 or 2 drink tickets a person, so you know that they're limited by 1 to 2 drinks max.
We're speaking with Jonathan Bell, employment attorney, also founder of the Bell Law Group in New York. We're talking about the do's and don'ts of holiday parties. So let's assume everybody, most people, understand the basics of proper etiquette and behavior at an office holiday party. What if you see something, though, and you're an employee and you think, wow, that should not be going on right now, or that should not be happening or be said between those 2 employees?
Right. So, okay, let's take it from an employee and from an employer standpoint. The employee doesn't technically have a duty to act, but I think it would be a good idea to basically go to your employer, manager, supervisor, kind of put them on notice of what they observe, so, and then at that point in time, the employer should take whatever actions necessary, whether it be calling somebody an Uber or a cab to go home, not let them drive, or potentially ordering them to stay away from a person if they feel like it could be borderline sexual harassment. if an employer, him or herself, observes this behavior, they should immediately act, because liability on most types of cases, or almost all types of cases, are based upon prior notice. You knew something, or you should have known something. If something's open and obvious and you're around, you should know about it. If you know about it, you have to take some action.
What about just simply saying no, thanks, but no thanks, maybe next year?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Going to the holiday party, do you just say, you know what, I'll skip it and just avoid everything, avoid all controversy?
That's true. You could take that approach. It's an extreme approach. I people look forward to it. People spend a lot of time at work with people, and they could really enjoy, for a camaraderie perspective, an office party. But you know what? If you really want to play it safe instead of nothing at all, go bowling. Don't serve alcohol. Go play ping pong. There's plenty of fun things that you could do, build camaraderie without having alcohol there, which unfortunately is the platform for people to act out and potentially expose you to liability.
Yeah. Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Bell, employment attorney and founder of the Bell Law Firm in New York. 21 minutes now after the hour.
And I would hang up my stocking at Christmas.
Hey, glad you're with us. If you play second fiddle to Santa Claus this time of year, there's a good chance you don't earn as much during public appearances, or maybe don't get booked for as many gigs. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Santa Claus gets paid. What about Mrs. Claus? As Ann Cadet of the Wall Street Journal tells us, men who portray Santa earn about $100 more an hour than women portraying his spouse. And that's not sitting well with some Mrs. Clauses. And who is paying for a Mrs. Claus visit?
Very few people in New York City. It's interesting. I went to profile kind of new Mrs. Claus on the scene. Her name is Ann Vota. She's a 45-year-old Mrs. Claus impersonator. She just got started a couple years ago, and she found that in New York City, nobody wants to hire a Mrs. Claus. Outside the city, she's super popular, but often people who hire a Santa to come to their event want a Mrs. Claus to come with him. And I think it's because outside of New York City, they're like concerned that, you know, Santa Claus is in a stable, happy, committed, married relationship. In New York, they might not care as much. So there's not a lot of call for a Mrs. Claus to appear with Santa, and then nobody wants Mrs. Claus on her own.
Outside of New York City, what do they want Mrs. Claus for? What kinds of things does she do?
It can vary. Typically, she'll be like one of the elves. She'll like escort the children to meet Santa. She might tell stories. She might be on hand to like do a cookie baking kind of situation. It was interesting when I learned more about this. Is it's a real kind of economic hierarchy in the whole Santa Land world. The very top Santas that you might see on national TV or appearing in ads can make anywhere from like $800 to $1,000 an hour. And then there's a group of Santas called the real bearded Santas, and these are men who grow their beards very long, so they kind of have to look like Santa all year long. And they're kind of premium Santas, and they'll make $200 to $300 an hour. If you don't have a real beard, then you can't command those nice top rates. And then kind of at the bottom of the hierarchy are the elves and Mrs. Claus.
We're speaking with Ann Cadet of the Wall Street Journal. Ann, what does Mrs. Claus look like? Is there a typical look for her?
It's interesting. The Santas, there are a lot of Santa associations across the nation, and they work very hard to make sure that Santas are kind of the same everywhere you go. But Mrs. Claus is kind of new, and she doesn't have the same backstory as Santa. There's not a lot of lore or legend behind Mrs. Claus. She's fairly new on the scene. So one thing that Mrs. Claus impersonators told me is they really like the idea that they can kind of invent whatever story they want about what Mrs. Claus does. The Mrs. Claus that I spoke to said she's in charge of the reindeer, and she's also in charge of all the logistics. So just like at UPS, you might have a team that's kind of overseeing where the trucks go, she's the person who kind of coordinates the sleigh route on Christmas Eve.
So the Mrs. Clauses who are out there are kind of winging it.
Yeah. Well, it depends. There are some more traditional Mrs. Clauses, but I also met, I hope I can remember remember her whole name, but there's a Santa Claus impersonator in the Hudson Valley, north of New York City, who refers to herself as something like Aurora, you know, Sovereign of the North, Aurora Borealis, Keeper of Promises, Mother of Reindeer, or something like that. And she's gotten a few gigs on her own as a Mrs. Claus, but it's more kind of, you know, trendy situations like an art gallery opening that aren't necessarily looking for the most traditional Santa Land affair.
Along the same lines, in all seriousness, there were mm-hmm. some stories recently that a lot of retailers and other malls and things like that yeah. needed to have Santa come in this year to get people and get foot traffic in their stores, and that separated mm-hmm. them from the online shopping thing. Is it possible yeah. that stores will actually turn to more characters in general to get people to come out?
I think it depends on, yes, obviously they need to do things like that. And I have been told by some Santa Claus agencies, they don't necessarily specialize just in Santa, but they might have a roster of dozens or even hundreds of Santas available to sort of rent out to stores, that demand has really grown in recent years, both because there's kind of just more money sloshing around in general, so more like, you know, corporate and private events can hire Santas, but also the stores are asking more and more for more Santas and more sort of elaborate Santa situations with multiple characters, yes.
That is the Wall Street Journal columnist and cadet with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Not a big summer guy. Too hot. Not a big winter guy either. Too cold. My favorite season? Safety season. Because it's every season. 24/7, 365. For all things safety, I trust Grainger. Grainger's safety experts have the safety solutions and expertise to help keep your facility safe and your people safer all year long. Seasons may change, but Grainger's always got your back. Call clickgrainger.com or stop by for all things safety. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Now that Human Resources VP Ashley Campbell has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, she's managing her workforce like a rock star. She even has her own hype song.
I'm the spark before the fire.
Have a really diverse workforce with different hours, skill sets, and pay grades. Now we're motivating and engaging the right people every step of the way.
Kronos. HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
It's the time of year when everyone is traveling or running around getting thoughtful gifts for the people you care about. But what about you? Gordon Deal here to tell you about Audible. Pamper yourself with an Audible membership. Get an unbeatable selection of audiobooks, including bestsellers, motivation, mysteries, and more. Choose three titles every month. That's one audiobook plus two exclusive Audible originals you can't hear anywhere else. And listen on any device, anytime, anywhere with the Audible app. When your holiday flight's delayed, you'll be so glad you signed up for Audible. For a limited time, get 3 months of Audible for just $6.95 a month. That's over 50% off. I just finished listening How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. I'm also a huge John Grisham fan, so one of his audiobooks is next. With Audible, you'll also enjoy easy audiobook exchanges and your own audiobook library that you keep forever, even if you cancel. Visit audible.com/Gordon or text Gordon to 500-500. That's audible.com/Gordon or text Gordon to 500-500.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. Like us on Facebook or send us an email. This Morning at CompassMediaNetworks.com.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, the one true way to succeed financially. Also, the newest frontier for financial advice might be an unusual spot. And the teacher who's gone viral for her Christmas homework assignment. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. An economy built on side hustles and providing convenience for strangers can become sketchy, it can become seedy, and sometimes even dangerous. Dalvin Brown, consumer tech reporter at USA Today, has an in-depth look at the sometimes consequences of the sharing economy. Dalvin, tell us about this crazy story about the guy from Utah.
So RJ Walker, he's a part-time Lyft driver. He drives home one day, ordinary day, and sees some strange cars in his driveway. And he walks up, sees strangers hanging out in his house, eating his food, and he's asked them, like, what's going on? How did this happen? And they tell him that the landlord listed the empty bedroom on Airbnb. And so, while that may sound startling for sure, it's not the only occurrence. The first time that Airbnb or any of these other sharing companies have come under fire for sketchy situations or seedy situations, and he was just one of the latest that I could find to highlight that trend.
Wow, as this guy described it, these other folks were hoteling in his house. They were using his soap and shampoo and all that.
Yeah, according to him, a lot of the things that he went out and bought were used as amenities and were listed as amenities on Airbnb. And of course, he couldn't, there was nothing Airbnb could do for him, is what he said. So he took to Twitter and local media to try to, blow up the situation, and he ended up getting evicted. And the landlord still runs the Airbnb, he says. So
why did he get evicted?
The landlord didn't like that he was talking to local media, I guess, about what. I didn't speak to the landlord, but,
wow.
According to him, they didn't like cameras around their home. And so he had to go, unfortunately. And, like I said, it's not just that situation. I mean, there's others where, on the flip side, there are homeowners who come home to discover that their homes are, destroyed after they, decided to list it on Airbnb, and people throw parties or, any number of other things could have happened. So, yeah, it's par for the course, I guess, when you're trusting strangers to do a service for you.
That is something. We're speaking with Dalvin Brown, consumer tech reporter at USA Today. He's written a piece about the darker side of sharing Ubers or Airbnbs. You said it's not that the sharing economy is any more dangerous than life before Uber and Airbnb. Explain that.
People have always been, ended up in unfortunate situations. I mean, even before Uber and Airbnb, there were incidents, unfortunate incidents of things happening at various hotels or, in taxis. There was always a version of being in situations where we didn't necessarily have total control. Before that, I think what's happening is that these companies are becoming bigger, and as they become bigger within the world of social media, where anyone can tell their story, we're hearing about these occurrences a lot more often. I mean, it could also be we don't pay attention a lot to what's happening around us nowadays, and before we know it, we're in a back alley somewhere. I mean, I was reading stories about, Lyft drivers attempting to kidnap people, and it's like, well, how does that happen? And in a lot of the cases, the people were on their phones, not paying attention to the route they were taking. So, yeah, I mean, what can you say? What can you do?
Thanks, Dalvin. Dalvin Brown, consumer tech reporter at USA Today. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. What does it take to succeed financially? Talking heads on cable TV may have you think otherwise, but when asked what's the most important financial virtue, almost all give the same answer. More from Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, set this up.
When you look at the discussion that happens in the financial media, whether it's on television, in newspaper, magazines, on the web, so much of it is about the minutiae of managing money, whether you should convert to a Roth, what direction stock prices are headed, what's going to happen to interest rates. And yet, when you get all these experts around a table and you say, well, what's the most important thing when it comes to financial success, almost all of them will say the same thing, which is great savings habits. If you don't have great savings habits, all the rest of this simply doesn't matter.
Explain how you say stuck with the same house for 20 years, even though you weren't in love with it, right? You've never really driven a new car. Those things add up.
Absolutely. The key to success is small steps that carry you forward, taking those steps consistently. So, for instance, when I bought my first house in 1992, soon after I bought the house and closed on it, this mortgage statement arrived in the mail with this tear-off coupon to send back the check with the next month's mortgage check. And there was the line for extra principal. I thought, oh, cool, you know, add a little extra principal. So I added $10 to that first monthly mortgage check, and I sent it back. And the statement arrived in the mail for the next month, and I could see the impact of that $10. So thereafter, every month, I added more and more. And the result was not only did I save tens of thousands of dollars in mortgage interest, but instead of paying off the mortgage over 30 years, I paid it off over 12 years.
Yeah. And then when it comes to cars, I mean, let somebody else pay the depreciation, right? Basic lesson there.
Yeah. I mean, when you drive a car off the lot of a dealership, you know, typically you lose 25 to 33% of the value right there. So one of the keys to financial success is to buy used cars. And indeed, you know, I've almost never in my life owned a new car. Almost all of them have been secondhand cars, and often they've had multiple different owners. And this could be a huge savings. For the typical American family, their car and all the related expenses with their car accounts for 16% of spending.
Mm. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com, and he's written a piece entitled Saving Myself. This perhaps was aided early on in your career, right? You ran into an editor, one of your first journalism gigs, where he basically told you your writing was garbage.
He used a slightly more colorful phrase, Gordon. He wrote on top of one of the articles I wrote, "This is and when I told him I was leaving the magazine, he said, "You seem smart enough. Maybe you could be an analyst, but you can't write to save your life."
Wow. And so you did what with that information?
Well, the particular article where he wrote "this is shit" across the top, I hung on to that article for years, looked at it. It provided some of the motivation to keep going. And, of course, you know, I went on to spend 20 years at the Wall Street Journal. There may be many things about me that are not top-notch, but one of them is certainly not my writing. That, people seem to agree, is really actually pretty good.
Explain, too, because you had a couple of side gigs that you did well with, and that, as you say, became gravy money in your whole scenario of trying to be a good saver.
When I moved from London to the United States in 1986, all I had to my name was credit card debt, and I had a fiance who was a graduate student, hence not making any money. You know, I was on a $20,000 a year salary at Forbes magazine. There was absolutely no money left over, and so the only way to find money to save was to have these windfalls, and all of those windfalls came from writing freelance articles. I would freelance for just about anybody to make a couple of $100. And when those windfalls arrived, I would immediately turn around and send them off to my investment accounts. And that's how I got started as an investor.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour. Hey, glad you could spend some time with us. The video sharing app TikTok, which has been a sensation among teens for more than a year, has several accounts aimed at saving you thousands of dollars. More from Andrew Keschner, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. Andy, I thought TikTok was silly lip sync videos.
There's definitely lots of that going on. But in addition to that, there's also some folks who are making videos about how to make money, well, how to save money by couponing and finding all these great deals online and in hard copy newspapers, and people who are giving advice on how not to rack up credit card debt and how to start saving soon for your retirement in an IRA. So it's all happening.
How do they do it in, I guess, a restricted amount of time, right? You can't go more than like a minute on TikTok?
That's right, yeah. You can't go more than a minute. It really depends. You know, some of the videos really lend themselves to just like a quick presentation, like a coupon deal, where one person, her name Katie Swanson, she goes by Coupon Katie. She shows these deals in a matter of 10 or so seconds, saying, go to this website, type in this promo code, boom, and you have free shipping on all the goods you do in this transaction, or go to Home Depot because they have a deal for a limited amount of time. So it can be these very quick deals, but for more complicated things like compound interest or the difference between real estate versus stocks, you know, they got to try their best in 60 seconds. And when I talk to the people who are making these videos, they'll be the first to tell you that no one's going to get a PhD off TikTok videos. It's basically sort of like a little appetizer on personal finance.
We're speaking with Andrew Keschner at MarketWatch. He's written a piece entitled The Newest Frontier for Financial Advice, TikTok. And if you don't know what TikTok is, it's a lip-syncing video sharing app, which is very popular among teens. Came out a year ago in the summer. I thought the guy, the teacher in Utah, who's got this financial literacy class, does a really good job. And he gets guidance from his students on how to improve the video, right? It's a good story.
Yeah, he over the summer he was thinking about what are the ways that he can best reach teens, students who he might not have in the classroom. Utah is one of about 20 states that mandates at least some sort of financial literacy instruction before a teen graduates. But that's 30 other states where teens are not getting that instruction. And he was thinking about the ways that he could reach people beyond his classroom. And he has kids himself, and they said, hey, I got this TikTok app and is really cool, and that's when the light went on for him. So now when he has a good lecture on debt or like a furniture financing offer or something like that, he'll give his cell phone to a student. He'll do like a little synopsis of what he just told them in the class, and then he posts it, and he gets a good amount of views. He has like, I think, 16,000 plus followers. That's much more than I have on any of my media accounts. So,
thanks, Andy. Andrew Keschner, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for being with us. Homework over the Christmas school break may not sound like something to celebrate, but one teacher's heartwarming assignment over the holidays is receiving approval from parents. A woman in Northern Ireland shared on Twitter the Christmas homework assignment her 4-year-old received last week. The assignment lists several tasks for students to complete. Spend time with the people you care about. Do the things you enjoy. Eat foods that you love. Watch your favorite TV program or movie. Make somebody laugh or smile. The homework also includes do something nice for somebody else. Visit your favorite place. Play with your toys. And finally, come back to school ready to learn. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.